You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Tomorrow it will be 107 years since the horrible murder of Mary Fagan at the filthy hands of Atlanta B'nai B'rith President Leo Frank. For all of those 107 years, Jewish groups, especially the ADL, birthed by the B'nai B'rith in that very year, have been screaming from all their media outlets, Leo Frank is good. Leo Frank didn't do it. Leo Frank is the real victim here. Leo Frank was a martyr to anti-Semitism. Well, let me tell you, Leo Frank is not the real victim. Leo Frank is not good. Leo Frank is just what the graphic at the top of the text version of this program says he is. Perjurer, strangler, rapist, abuser, pedophile, sweatshop boss, and murderer. And let us never forget Mary Fagan, a little 13-year-old girl forced to labor by an unjust economic system for a few cents an hour, making pencils in Leo Frank's sweatshop. She is the only victim. She was but a child. She was innocent. She was tricked. She was trapped. She was beaten. She was raped. She was strangled to death. And when the man who did those crimes was caught and turned out to be a prominent Jew, a high official in the Jewish B'nai B'rith, the multi-million-dollar publicity and lie machine got revved up to the red line for the first time in American history. They tried and tried every crooked way they knew how to get their man off. And they almost did. And when a group of Georgians went around their corrupt government and carried out the court's just sentence, the Jewish power structure re-intensified their propaganda campaign to make the world think Leo Frank was a persecuted angel. And they haven't stopped their lying, wailing, and screaming since. It's in the news again. Right now, in April 2020, they're obsessed with Leo Frank. It's as if they think that if they can help Frank get away with it, then the rest of them can get away with anything. Jeffrey Epstein style, Harvey Weinstein style, and beyond. Leo Frank the martyr, Leo Frank the angel, Leo Frank the innocent. Leo Frank, the persecuted Jew. Enough! Today I am going to show you how crooked and disingenuous their campaign has been. But first, let's acknowledge that Leo Frank should not be the main focus of this day. We should be commemorating the life cut short of one who much more deserves to be called an angel. One who might have lived and loved all the way into the 1980s and made her mark upon the world. A white girl who might have given sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters to our people. And who knows what they might have done. we should be commemorating Mary Fagan. Let us now observe a moment of silent reflection in memory of her. Join me now in silent thought. We have given our thoughts to Mary Fagan today on the 107th anniversary of her violent death. We have reflected on what she might have been, what she might have done, and what she deserved from life. Love, marriage, laughter, joy, learning, children, accomplishment, satisfaction. And what she did not deserve, to be tricked, trapped, propositioned by her Jewish sweatshop boss, knocked unconscious and bloody when she resisted, raped, strangled, and thrown in the coal dust before the furnace, ready to be burned. I don't have time in one radio program to recapitulate the mountain of evidence that Leo Frank is guilty and that convinced every court at every level to affirm his conviction, as did every jury, including the coroner's jury that included a disproportionately large number of Jews. We've covered much of that evidence here on National Vanguard, but let me just touch on a very few high points that the Jewish-run media always ignore. Mary Fagan met her death at the National Pencil Factory where she worked on April 26, 1913, when she came to pick up her pathetic $1.20 pay for the week. Numerous pieces of evidence prove the place of her death was on the second floor, between her workstation in what was called the metal room and the metal room bathroom. Numerous pieces of evidence also prove that no one except Mary Fagan and Leo Frank were on the second floor at that time. There were six people in the building, including Mary and Leo Frank, when the murder took place. Two workmen and a workman's wife on an upper floor. They were together and couldn't have done it. Leo Frank and Mary Fagan on the second floor together. And Jim Conley keeping watch for Frank near the front door of the building, visible from the outside. And in the place with the highest amount of traffic of people going in and out, a preposterously unlikely place for a rape and strangling. And the evidence shows it didn't happen there anyway. Furthermore, Leo Frank, by his own statement, sitting in his totally open office just at the top of the stairs near Conley, heard no screams, no thuds or thumps, no struggle, nothing. So Conley's out. So basically it comes down to this simple equation. There were six people in the building and we know that five of them didn't do it. That leaves Leo Frank. Also, innocent people don't try to frame other innocent people. Who but someone on the Frank team had a motive to plant the fake bloody shirt found at the black night watchman's house? The watchman, Newt Lee, has been proven to be absolutely innocent, and the shirt has been absolutely proven to be a plant. So who was trying to frame him? You have 1 millisecond to give your answer. Again, innocent people don't try to frame other innocent people. And yet another attempt to frame another innocent black man was made when the frame-up of Newt Lee fell apart. This time, a fake Bloody Club and a fake Mary Fagan pay envelope were conveniently found by a corrupt detective in Frank's employ near the exact spot where Jim Conley had been sitting on the fatal day. The fakes were exposed when numerous private and police detectives testified that they had searched that exact spot the day after the murder, and nothing was there. Further discredit was cast on the fakes when the medical examiner said the club couldn't have been the murder weapon. Once again, in case you didn't get it the first time, innocent people don't try to frame other innocent people. Oh, and did I mention that some 20 young girls, workers in Frank's sweatshop, testified that he had spied on them in their dressing rooms, that he touched their breasts, that he fondled them inappropriately, and that he offered money to them for sex. Then there's this, reported by many newspapers at the time, but never mentioned ever by the controlled media today in their constant stream of whitewash propaganda for Leo Frank. The astounding, repeated, huge number of cases of witnesses being bribed to lie on the stand, to sign false affidavits, to leave town and become unfindable, and even the use of sexual bait and forged letters to facilitate the framing of Conley and a new trial for Frank. These illegal, corrupt, and truly evil acts were documented, as I said, in many newspapers at the time, but have almost been erased by the Jewish media monopolies. I recently came across one in my research on the case. It's from a northern newspaper, and northern newspapers, following the Jewish lead and Jewish money, or simply believing in their line, were uniformly pro-Frank. Nevertheless, one of their reporters honestly reported on a court hearing in Georgia and what was said there. The date was May 5, 1914, and the occasion was a hearing in which the highly paid Dream Team lawyers for Frank were trying to void his conviction and get him a new trial. The newspaper was Boston's Traveler and Evening Herald. The report states in part, quote, headline, says he got $300 to lie for Frank. Preacher and others swear they were paid to testify falsely in the Fagan murder case. Several sensations developed at the hearing of the extraordinary motion for a new trial for Leo M. Frank, convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan, before Judge B.H. Hill. Affidavits were introduced by Solicitor General Dorsey, charging bribery and forgery by agents of the defense, and alleging a deliberate attempt to manufacture false evidence to hang the Negro, Jim Conley, for the murder. Judge Hill, near the close of the hearing, announced that he wished an order issued for the return to Atlanta of Annie M. Carter, the negress who swore that Conley had confessed to her that he was the murderer of Mary Fagan. Detective Burns, who was working for Frank, on the stand, said that it was at his suggestion that Annie Carter was sent from the jurisdiction of this court, commented the judge. Unless she is returned within 5 days by the persons who sent her away, her letters and all of the matter to which she testified will not be considered in rendering a decision on the motion. A letter from the woman to her father said that she was working for William Burns, who was a detective in the employ of Leo Frank, in New Orleans and going under the name of Mrs. Joseph Griffin. An affidavit was made by the Reverend C.B. Ragsdale, in which he directly charged that attorney Arthur Thurman also on the Frank legal team, had inspired the famous confession affidavit, and that Thurman personally had paid him $200 and had paid R.L. Barber $100 for their signatures. Convict tells of conspiracy. This was followed by an affidavit by Fred Perkerson, a former convict at the county jail, who related a conspiracy he said had been outlined by Dr. George Wren, who worked for Frank, also at the jail, to visit the cell of Jim Conley and then to swear that Conley had confessed to them. Frank Reese, a Negro trustee at the jail, swore to similar efforts of Wren to persuade him to take part in the conspiracy. Reese said Wren tried to induce Conley to take the crime on himself, saying that he would be let off in a year or so and get a lot of money, and that Frank would go free. He indicated that the Annie Carter notes were part of a frame-up by Wren. Affidavits were produced from Philip Chambers, formerly office boy at the National Pencil Factory, and J.M. Gant, also an ex-employee, swearing that the affiants were in the office of Frank when the desk of H.P. Becker, formerly master mechanic, was brought down into Frank's office. They declared that all of the old order blanks, including the old carbons of requisitions, such as the Fagan murder notes were written on, were removed from the desk and placed in the outer office not more than 10 feet from Frank's office, thus proving that the Frank defense team's claim that all such order blanks were in the basement only was a lie. Both said they never had known of the order blanks being taken to the basement and destroyed, nor of pads of this sort lying around in the basement. See, Brutus Dalton, back from Fort Myers, Florida, repudiated in an affidavit the statement he had made for Captain C.W. Burke, agent for Frank's attorneys, and charged that Burke had offered him $300 for his signature. Burke, according to Dalton, represented that he wanted Dalton to sign a petition to present to the pardon board to save Frank from hanging. Dalton said he was in a hurry, that Burke read him a small part of the affidavit, but that there was no reference to the testimony he gave at the trial in the part he was allowed to hear. Dalton swore that his evidence at the trial in regard to acts of perversion by Frank was true. An affidavit from Mary Rich repudiated the affidavit in which she said that she saw Jim Conley cross the rear of the pencil factory at 1:11 o'clock on the afternoon of April 26. An affidavit of the Negro, Ivy Jones, branded as a forgery the affidavit accredited to him by the defense. Affidavits from Conley and another Negro, Eugene Perry, corroborated Jones in his story of meeting Conley shortly after 1:30 o'clock on April 26. A long affidavit signed by Jim Conley was read, in denial of every essential statement in the quote-unquote confession affidavit by Annie Carter, in which she charged Conley with telling her of killing Mary Fagan. Conley said the woman had slipped him letters, but that one day he saw Dr. Wren drop her a letter from the second floor of the jail, and that she a few minutes later delivered it to him as one of her own letters. Conley charged that a deputy left the door open so that friends of Frank could get into his cell block. Night Rides with Agent. An affidavit from J.E. Duffer told of a night ride to Austell with agents for Frank in an endeavor to keep the witness from detectives from Dorsey's office who were trying to get him to the solicitor's office. Helen Ferguson, said an offer of $100 was made to her if she would leave town. This failing, she said, Wren went to her under the name of J.W. Howard, and after that, he began taking her to theaters and paying her attentions, finally proposing marriage. She said that she went with him to the Grant Building and there was induced to sign an affidavit, telling of an occasion when she had been frightened by Conley. This, she said, was after she had refused to sign one, changing her testimony on the stand. She said she met Burke, who represented himself as Wren's father. Later, she said, Wren renewed his protestations of love and sought to kiss her. She slapped his face, and thereafter his ardor cooled, according to the affidavit. Close quote. So there you have it. Planting false letters on an imprisoned black man after enticing him with a paid whore to get his confidence. Falsely and cruelly using the affections of a young woman to trick her into signing false affidavits. Paying witnesses to skip town. Brazenly handing out money to suborn false testimony and get witnesses to pretend to have witnessed events and confessions which never took place. All to frame an innocent man. All to get a real rapist and a real killer off the hook. How many times do I have to say it? Innocent people don't do such things. Leo Frank coldly manipulated a 13-year-old white girl who depended on him for her tiny wage into a sexual trap. When she resisted, he attacked her and knocked her unconscious. While she was unconscious, he raped and defiled her. Then, to make sure she wouldn't tell what he did and spoil his cushy life, he tied a rough cord around her neck until her tongue stuck out, and then left it there until she was dead. He then called downstairs for Jim Conley. See how close he was to him? To come up and help him move the body in preparation for burning it. Just before he called Conley, though, he tied a torn piece of Mary's lace underclothing around her neck. A most curious and telling thing, this tying of the lace. Would Conley have done this had he been the killer? No, there was no reason for him to do so. It wouldn't have hidden the rope or the rope marks from even the dullest policeman for more than a minute or two. But Frank, a skinny runt, needed Conley's help to move the body. The lace would cover the rope and the rope marks just long enough, he thought, to prevent Conley from seeing that Frank's claim that he had accidentally killed Mary was a lie. The lace might keep Conley in the dark long enough for him to move the body. Can you think of any other explanation for the lace? The evidence is overwhelming, and it all tells us not only that Frank was lying and that his team was lying, suborning perjury and framing others. It also tells us that the Jewish-controlled media have lied to us about it for more than a century now. Next week, we're going to expose more of their hoaxes and show you the significance for us today of this first and still continuing frenzied media campaign to exonerate this highly symbolic Jewish sex killer, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kinds of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of woman who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with the conservatives, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just to dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this. National socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us, are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker, nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. They're no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life, just like here, could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say, we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I've pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, antisocial doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Send them, let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books, and the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of it, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a ball. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people, and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people and the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.